Committee. First of all, I want to say we had a great tour this morning. We've been out of the building, and I want to thank everyone who worked very hard at putting that together. Sandy Flicker and our committee administrator put this all together, and it was great. So we apologize for being a little late, but we had a great time and a good walk. So, Representative Lee, we missed you. So thank you, committee, for going. It was great.
That's great.
So we'll just get right on with our agenda, and we have the transmission issues and new resources next, and we have Brian Silverstein and Ann Morrow going to give us a presentation. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us. My name is Ann Morrow. I work as a constituent account executive for the Bonneville Power Administration, and I've been following this committee and some of the work in the interim over the last several months. I just wanted to give you a couple of pieces of information about Bonneville in general. We have a footprint in the region, the four states of Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and Montana. I wanted to let you know a little bit about what we do in Oregon. We have 36 consumer-owned utilities in Oregon that get their power from Bonneville. Many of them, that's all the supply of their power is Bonneville. We also provide the investor-owned utilities in Oregon, PGE, PacifiCorp, and Idaho, with benefits through what is called the Residential Exchange Program. And we also provide a little bit of power to some of those in the past. Currently, it's all in monetary benefits, so it's an agreed-upon sum. We have a fairly large fish and wildlife project in Oregon that's done through the Northwest Power Planning Council. We have spent about $400 million in Oregon in the last several years. We do a lot of energy efficiencies through those consumer-owned utilities, and we also have a fairly large transmission footprint in the state. And I'm going to brought Brian down to talk to you about that transmission footprint and your issue of renewables in specific. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate the chair and the committee offering to have us come down and talk about transmission issues. And if you'd like to see some really big electric power facilities, we'd be happy to take you a tour on some of our facilities in the state of Oregon as well. So there are a few things that I'd like to chat about today. Some background information on Bonneville transmission responsibilities, status of wind interconnection in the Northwest, and then talk about some of the challenges. And it's really the focus of my conversation, both the transmission and then dealing with the variability of wind as a resource, and then some next steps that I'd like to suggest for you to consider. So I'm sure you folks are well aware that Bonneville is the major transmission provider in the Northwest. Depending upon what yardstick you use, we provide about 3/4 of the bulk transmission facilities. So the consumer-owned utilities and the investor-owned utilities depend upon Bonneville to deliver power from where it's generated to the consumers. And we are a pretty big business. Just the transmission side alone is a $650 million a year utility business. This map sketches out the transmission grid in the Northwest. The facilities in red, both the solid lines and the dotted lines, are Bonneville's facilities. And you can see there are other portions that are owned by the other investor-owned utilities. So while we are the major provider, we can't do it alone. And it does operate as one large interconnected machine. One of the challenges that we face as utility planners and operators is that electrons can't read contracts. And so power flows as it flows according to the laws of physics, and we have to work together to provide a reliable and economic grid for consumers in the region. This is a map of the service territories in the state of Oregon. The various colored areas are the service territories of the consumer-owned utilities, the municipals, cooperatives, and public utility districts. The areas in white are the investor-owned utilities, Portland General Electric in the Portland area and down the Willamette Valley, most of the rest PacifiCorp and some Idaho Power. But you can see how they interleave together across the state of Oregon. In 2000 and 2001, we were in the midst of the energy crisis in the western United States. I'm sure you folks are well aware of that. One of the reasons that we had such problems in the West was because of lack of investment in transmission. As you folks well know, we had a very robust economy in the 1990s in the region. And it's amazing that we went the period of 15 years without adding significant facilities to the transmission grid. We basically tried to work smarter. We tried to stretch the facilities that we did have as much as possible through high-speed communications and controls, high-tech devices. But we came to the conclusion about 2000-2001 that we had just gone too far. And so Bonneville identified an infrastructure program consisting of 20 potential transmission projects. And we launched that in 2001 with very strong support from the region, from the utility community, from the state legislatures, from the governor's offices, from the congressional delegation. And we really appreciate that we had the confidence and the support of the region, because that allowed us to go to Washington, D.C. and increase the borrowing authority for Bonneville so we could afford to build those facilities. Over the past 4 years, Bonneville has invested more than $1 billion in transmission infrastructure. About half of that in the major projects that we talked about, and the other half in the more mundane things, from replacing roofs and air conditioning and radios and control equipment to local area service projects. We completed 160 miles of 500 kV transmission line. KV is kilovolts, so 500,000 volts is the highest voltage line that we operate in the Northwest. We completed three lines. We modernized the direct current converter terminal, which is located near the Dalles, Oregon. This is a really important facility that ties the Northwest directly to the Los Angeles area. It's very important for the economy of the Northwest because it allows us to exchange power during different times of the year. Typically, we'll be shipping power to the south in the summer and receiving it in the wintertime when our loads tend to peak in the region. So we had 1960s technology, essentially large vacuum tubes, which we replaced with solid-state devices. So I expect that'll be good for another 30 or 40 years. And as I said, there were a number of local service projects. I point out two in Oregon. We installed a new transformer to allow us to provide reliable service to the growing loads southwest of Portland. And nearby, we replaced the Albany-Eugene 115 kilovolt line. So that was a World War II vintage line. We have growing loads in the area. We had reliability of service issue, particularly for some industrial loads. And so we rebuilt the line 2 years ago. If you have any questions about what I'm going through here, please stop me and go ahead and ask. Otherwise, I'll chug on through the slides. This map identifies the major transmission projects. The projects in the kind of goldish-brown color are those that are completed that were referred to on the previous slide. The projects in green are underway, and in fact, the one in central Washington actually was just completed a couple months ago, so I guess we need to update this map. The projects in blue are proposed projects, potential projects. Notice South Oregon Coast. We have some projects underway to provide reliable service to the communities at the ends of our system. And one thing I really want to call your attention to, there are several transmission projects in red on this map. And those are projects that were identified as potential projects back in 2000-2001 and were either put on hold or canceled. The main reason, let me describe the nature of these projects. There are generally facilities that were driven by the need to interconnect new generation. And there was expectation of significant new generation to be built in the region. Some did get done. Independent power producers built gas turbines. There were some wind projects built. But with the downturn in the economy after the energy crisis, a lot of the generation projects were canceled. So along with that, we canceled the transmission that goes with them, because we did want to build facilities, invest hundreds of millions of dollars in transmission facilities if they weren't going to be used. The challenge will come to us now as we see the need for new resources, for new generation in the Northwest. We have to get that delivered. We need the transmission facilities to move it from where it's generated to where it's consumed. And 85% of the consumption is in the Interstate 5 corridor from the Seattle suburbs in the north all the way down to the Medford area. So at some point, we're going to need to build new transmission facilities. And that's one of the challenges, which I'll describe again a little bit later on in the presentation. This rather busy map is a schematic of how the transmission engineers examine the grid. The skinny blue lines are transmission facilities, and in this map, all of the lines, those owned by Bonneville, those owned by others, are shown on this map. The red lines with the names on them are the choke points on the grid where the transmission is constrained. We call them constraints or flow gates or cut planes. And so you see some of the red lines cross one or more of the blue transmission lines. So they're basically lines that we group together for purposes of discussion and study to understand where the limitations are, starting on the Canadian border to the north to the various lines that cross over into California on the southern end of the system. So let me just describe briefly, because this is very important to understand the need for transmission to deliver renewable resources to consumers. As I said, the majority of the load in the Northwest is in the Interstate 5 corridor. And there's a relatively modest amount of generation in the I-5 corridor. So all of that generation has to be delivered across the Cascade Mountains to the load centers, to the Portland, Seattle load centers and the points in between and south of there. And so you see constraints across Cascades north to the Puget Sound area, across Cascades south into the Portland area. That's one of the constraints that we have. And typically, in the wintertime, power tends to flow from east to west across the system into the I-5 corridor. In the summertime, we have different challenges. The power tends to flow north to south, from Canada into the Northwest and south into California to support the large loads during the cooling season in the summertime. So we see different patterns here. One area that I'd like to point your attention to, if you can, with your mind's eye, find the Columbia River going through this map, the Washington-Oregon border, and you see there are several constraints in series to the east there, west of Slat, west of McNary. That's the area where a lot of the wind projects are located, in central Oregon, central Washington. And that energy is going to try to get west, either to go south to California in the summertime or to Portland in the wintertime. And so that's one of the bottlenecks that we're going to have to address if we start developing large amounts of wind resources. It also happens to be a location where two major gas pipelines cross. And there are some gas turbine plants in that area, and there have been proposals in the past for a large number of additional gas turbines, which have some were built, some were deferred because of the energy crisis and the high price of natural gas. But when the region starts developing resources, I would expect that a large portion of them are going to be remote, and they're going to want to come across that path. Now let's add on top of that what might occur further east. If we see development of coal in Wyoming, in Montana, oil sands in Alberta, that power also is going to have to travel east to west across the Cascades, and again we'll be trying to climb onto the same electric highway system to get to consumers in the Interstate 5 corridor. So I think we pretty well know where the choke points are in the transmission system where we're going to need to make investments. The path from McNary to the west, we actually had a proposal to build a transmission line. The various generation developers provided the money for us to do the environmental work, to do the design work, the permitting, and that's all complete. The only thing we're looking for is funding. And so when the generation projects went away, we put the project on the back burner, but we still have the permitting and we still have the designs available. So in that situation, we're pretty well equipped because we could probably move to build the line in about 2 years. But if we were starting from scratch, if someone to say ask us to launch a project that we haven't done any work on, it could be 5 or more years before we could build a transmission line. And so it's interesting, we're in a situation today where generation projects, particularly wind, maybe gas turbines, can be built much faster than the transmission lines. So that may be the limitation on our ability to deliver power. So we really need to be thinking forward. We need to be thinking ahead. Any questions about the background?
Yeah, excuse me. I'd like a little more information on these constraints. I mean, the Cascades, I can see, presumably you're talking about a physical barrier, you know, getting lines over the mountains across federal lands and that. But what are the constraints, for example, west of Slat and west of McNary? What are those? Is it just that you don't have, the lines aren't big enough to carry the capacity, or...
That's correct. There's insufficient transmission capability to move the power across those paths. So it would be like a point on the freeway system. If you build 3 lanes all the way, but the traffic is really busy in Portland, you may need to add a 4th lane in that particular area. So that's some of the constraints. The constraints can be just the physical capability of the lines. Is there enough aluminum conductor hanging in the air to carry all the power? Or quite often there's system limitations. Can we keep the voltages up? Can we respond acceptably if something goes wrong, if a power line gets knocked down by a windstorm or an ice storm? Because we have to be prepared for all of those contingencies. Otherwise, you would end up with a widespread blackout like we experienced in the Northeast in the summer of 2003. And remember, that has happened in our region as well. There was a blackout in August of 1996 that originated on the Bonneville system and spread to 12 western states. So we want to be sure that that happens. And to do that, one of the things we do is limit the amount of power we'll allow to travel over a transmission path, because we have to be prepared, according to reliability standards, for one or more of those lines to go out of service due to some problem, wind, ice, or whatever.
Hmm. Thank you.
So I want to give a little bit more background about renewable generation. I think you folks well understand that there's a strong interest in the region in developing renewable generation, in particular wind. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council's latest five-year power plan identifies the potential for 5,000 to 6,000 megawatts of wind generation. I'm going to share some information for you, a map and actual list of projects for you. When we looked at the transmission map, we looked at the west of Slat area. We're talking at the point we call the bend in the river, where the Columbia River goes from north-south to east-west. Each of those red crosses is a potential wind project, and I've got the project name and the rating in megawatts, some small, some very large. And you can really see the huge concentration in a couple of areas, basically in along the Columbia River there, both on the Oregon and Washington side, in central Washington, the Ellensburg area, and then to the east in the Walla Walla area, are the three major sites for wind development within our region. I should point out that there also are wind development opportunities in Montana, Wyoming, southern Idaho, but I was focusing here, of course, for our conversation on the state of Oregon. But this is both a blessing and a curse because of the concentration. It makes it easier for us to gather the wind projects together, put them on a transmission line, and deliver them to the west. But it also presents other challenges because they're grouped together, both simply having enough transmission facilities to move it and also dealing with the variability in the wind. Because the projects are so close together geographically, as the wind picks up and the wind slows down, all the wind projects tend to ramp up together, and then when the wind dies down, they all tend to come down together. We don't have a lot of geographic diversity in the wind projects, particularly in the state of Oregon. You can see how concentrated they are. This is a little bit of history of wind development in the Bonneville Service Territory. So at the end of 2004, we had 250 megawatts of wind development. So with today's large wind turbines, so that could be anywhere, probably in that size, that was probably maybe up to 100 wind turbines or more. So it's interesting to see that some of those projects are relatively small, from 15 megawatts, the largest ranging, to 90 megawatts. This past year, we added two wind projects which doubled the amount of wind generation in the Bonneville system, 478 megawatts. And if you flip to the next page, by the end of this year, we could see the wind generation nearly doubling again. I don't think we're going to get quite to these levels. The megawatts that you see for each of the projects are the maximum amounts that they're permitted for. And what we're finding is that the developers are probably going to have to stage that build out, both for the market need and quite simply because of the challenge in acquiring wind turbines. There's such a demand for wind turbines, not only in the Northwest United States, but in the world market, that developers are having trouble buying the number of wind turbines that they need. So my guess is that by the end of this year, we'll probably be more like 800 to 850 megawatts on the Bonneville system. I expect that the build-out of those projects will probably be completed in sometime in 2007. Now comes the big speculation. Where are we going to be in another year? If you just look at the requests, people who've said to Bonneville who are interested in building a project, we could end up with up to 2,500 megawatts of wind hooked up to the Bonneville system by 2007. Now, I have to admit, I've given up the betting game on who the winners are, who's actually going to complete their project. My relationship, Bonneville's relationship with the developers, are those who sign the necessary agreements and provide the funding to build the facilities. Those are the ones that we're working on, and we have construction underway for several substations to allow us to hook up more wind projects. But you can see the number increasing very rapidly, and some things that have been relatively easy for us to manage are going to become more and more of a challenge as the percentage of resources, as the percent of generation in the Northwest grows larger and larger. Because right now, with only about 400 or 500 megawatts, it's barely noticeable. You know, except at the local geographic area, it's really just a blip when we have 25,000 megawatts of generation connected to the Bonneville control area. But in the future, it's going to become a larger and larger penetration, which will give us some more problems. So I want to talk about the transmission facilities, and I need to explain a little bit about the way we have a relationship with transmission developers. There are really two things that we think about when we're hooking up a wind project to the grid. One is the interconnection, which is simply taking the wind project and plugging it into the nearest point where the grid comes by. Hey, that's generally a very small amount of facilities. The other part of the transmission service of delivering the power from where it's generated to the consumers 100 or 200 miles away. And I want to address each of those separately because keep in mind there are two pieces and they're treated separately, but really you need both of them to ultimately get the power integrated into the system. So the basic framework that we use is on our transmission tariff. This is all described by FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and Bonneville chose in 1996 to voluntarily comply with the FERC open access rules, just as the investor-owned utilities are required to. So our ways of dealing with wind and any other generator were described in FERC Order 2003. Basically, there are a couple of pieces that we have to deal with. The first thing is what I would call the extension cord, going from the wind farm to the substation. And that's always been the responsibility of the wind developer. It's for their sole benefit. They have the responsibility to build that line and bring it to the Bonneville grid. Then we would build a substation if there isn't one there, or additions to an existing substation. That's like the on-off switch where you connect things together. So if there's a problem, we can disconnect the wind farm, and we can also protect the wind generators for problems on the grid. The business model for that is the developer is asked to provide the funding to Bonneville to build those facilities at the substation. In exchange for that funding, they receive a transmission credit. And basically what that means is they have essentially prepaid for transmission service. They put the money up front. That takes care of borrowing the money or funding the money to build those interconnection facilities, and they can then work that off over a period of years. If you're interested in the amount of dollars involved, it can range from maybe $500,000 for a small wind project that just happens to be located in the right place where the right facilities are already there to $10 million. And again, this is just for the substation facilities to get the generator hooked up to the grid. The $10 million price is for a pretty large one, where we're seeing wind farms on the order of 500 megawatts or larger. They look just like a gas turbine or a coal plant. I mean, these are getting very big. These aren't the mom and pop backyard generators anymore. And they need facilities to be sure they can be safely and reliably hooked up.
Wind generation is not consistent over the year, right? It has highs and lows. So you have to manage the electrical system to include that influx. Does it match with the production that Bonneville is regularly doing, or is there a problem with peak production times when there's too much electricity for the grid?
That's a great question. If you would allow me just a few more minutes to get into the next section of slides, I'll talk about that. But that is one of the challenges, because some of the facilities may need to be built to carry the full output of the wind project. The second piece I wanted to talk about was transmission service. So this is moving the wind once it's hooked up to the grid, let's say in the Condon area, and delivering it to consumers in the Portland area. And again, the business practices are in our transmission tariff. There are two types of service, basically, that we provide, two types of transmission service. One is called long-term firm, and that basically says you sign a contract and we guarantee you service 365 days a year for the next 20 years. And in some cases, if we don't have the facilities, we may have to build something to deliver that service. The other model that we use is what's called non-firm, where people just say, I'd like to use your grid the next hour. If you have any room, can I get it? We say yes, we'll sell it to them for the hour or the next hour or the hour after that. If there's a problem, if we have a limitation, the people with non-firm service are the ones that we ask to get off first. It's like people flying standby, whereas the people in the first group are the ones with confirmed service. Now, that's not guaranteed 100% availability, but it's pretty high availability because we couldn't afford to guarantee 100% of the time. But an important part of the long-term firm service, the model is first come, first served. So people who request transmission service get in the waiting queue. There's a very standardized process that we follow, no matter what type of resource, no matter who the requester is, whether it's investor-owned, consumer-owned utility, whether it's Bonneville's own federal resources. They get in line. But this may present some challenges because, for example, on those constraints west of McNary, there are already people in line in the queue waiting to use that transmission system. Some of them are wind developers. Some of them have other gas turbines. Some of them are just requesting the service because they think it might be useful at some point. This is really one of the challenges that we face. If service can't be provided, then we'll go ahead and do studies, and there's a step-by-step process that I won't take you through. Ultimately, what we'll do when the design and environmental work is complete, we'll offer the party who requests the service a transmission contract, typically a 20-year contract. We'll ask them to provide funding for a share of the facilities, because quite often these facilities are so large that you wouldn't build a transmission line just for a single generation project. The John Day McNary project, for example, that we're considering probably would have had four or five people sharing in the cost. But you can see the dollar amount now. This is much larger in scale than we talked about in the previous page of $500,000 to $10 million. Now we're talking about a $175 million transmission project. That's a big deal, and that really is a challenge for people who are looking to develop new generation. But let me put that number in perspective for you. Let's just say that we were to deliver 1,000 megawatts of new generation over this line. If that was a wind farm rated at 1,000 megawatts, that would probably cost about $1.1 billion to $1.25 billion for the developer to invest in the wind farm. Okay? So while $175 million is a very large chunk of change, it's probably only 10 to 15% of the capital cost of the project. It's part of the cost of developing resources that are remote from consumers. And that's the challenge that we face. Where we choose to live in the I-5 corridor, the wind resource is not consistent enough to make it usable for economic investment. And where the wind blows strong, there aren't a lot of people living. So we have part of the cost of developing that resource is the transmission facilities to deliver it to consumers. So what I did on this page was just list some of the challenges and then some of the places that I think we can get past this, because I want to be clear. There's nothing in my presentation that is an obstacle to getting wind developed and hooked up into the grid. There are challenges that we have to face and find our way through. Some are technical, some are political, some are economic, but they're all solvable problems. So challenges, the transmission queue, which I just described, first come, first served. One of the challenges that we face is sometimes it's not just one transmission path that's limited, but there are several. And you have questions about who's first in line, who makes investment for one path versus the other path. Some very difficult issues, to be honest. When the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission set out their rules for this process, they didn't even think about this stuff. They hadn't anticipated what the real world looks like. They had a very simple model in mind for it to work in. The construction times I mentioned, the long lead time compared to developing generation, and then the financing question. Because Bonneville has limited financing authority, and I do not believe that we could fund the development of all the transmission facilities to deliver remote resources, whether it's wind in central Oregon to the oil sands in Alberta, a new coal and wind generation in Montana, Wyoming. That would probably empty Bonneville's borrowing authority. So that's an issue that we need to find. There are alternative models, the developer funding a portion. Bonneville has used third-party financing, where we basically went to investment bankers. And one of our infrastructure projects, the one we built in central Washington, the transmission line was financed by an investment bank. That works very well. The downside is the interest rates are higher than our cost of borrowing from the United States Treasury, but it's a way to ensure that there's a borrowing authority available. some solutions, some things that might help us get through this. One is to change the model that we use, the paradigm. There's been a tradition in the utility industry for a long time, 50, 75, 100 years. If you build a new resource and you want to count on that to serve your customers, you need to have firm transmission. You need to have reliable transmission. Okay? Now think about wind, which operates on average of 30 to 35% of the time. If you built a 100 megawatt wind farm, and on average it delivered 30 or 35 megawatts, why should you pay for 100 megawatts of transmission? But that's the model that people have in their mind. To be honest, that's the model that the state regulators had. And so when they design their RFPs, or requests for proposals, they have an expectation of being able to deliver the firm output of the project. I would argue that's a very poor use of transmission resources. And what I would certainly suggest is it's really a risk management question. And you'd probably want to buy one block of firm and then move maybe another portion using non-firm as available. I think that we need to rethink the way we deliver renewable resources. Look at other approaches to dealing with congestion. The Weston McNairy path that I described is actually only congested a very small amount of the time, basically when the hydro operation and the lower Snake is way up. If that only happens for a week or two a year, under our business model, we can't sell that at firm transmission because we can look at the graph of the data and say there are certain times where I can't guarantee that, so I can't sell it to you. But you know what? From a practical standpoint, it's there almost all the time. So why don't we find a way for people to use that? And if it turns out for a given hour, for a couple of weeks, it's constrained, let's find a way to balance the system. Maybe turn down a gas turbine. I mean, why would you want to burn $6 gas if you can run wind? So we need to find a way to work out a business relationship where some generation is brought down when other generation is built up. Develop new transmission projects. Look at financing models, participation by a number of entities. And ultimately, one of the things that we need is a coordinated regional transmission plan because, as I said, Bonneville is not the only transmission owner. Any questions about transmission before I go to the variability question that was raised?
Guess not.
Here's a rather busy graph. This is over one 24-hour period. It's for a particular wind farm. I won't name the name of the project. Its total output is about 150 megawatts. There are two traces on the map. One is a kind of pinkish squared-off line. That's the forecast of the wind output. Okay, and those are one-hour blocks, so you can see it's stepping down and up. That's what they forecasted. The blue squiggly line is the actual output. Now, I want to tell you the vintage of that forecast. That forecast was made 30 minutes before the hour. This isn't a day ahead. This is what they forecasted 30 minutes before the hour. Particularly if you look over a couple of those to the right, you see a huge drop where it goes from about 130 megawatts down to about 30 megawatts. And the forecast was it was going to stay at about 130 megawatts for the next hour. So our ability to predict the output of the wind projects is just one of the challenges that we face in integrating it. Part of the reason, to be honest, is people are using pretty unsophisticated approaches. The basic model that most wind farms use for forecasting is called the persistence model. That sounds like a high-tech statistical approach. Basically, they said, what happened last hour? I guess the same thing will happen next hour. So that's the forecasting tool. And you can see that the change in wind obviously goes up as the cell comes over and wind starts picking up, and it can go back down. Now, if the wind starts rising, that's not really that big a deal because we can back down generation. That's a relatively easy thing to do. But when the wind drops precipitously, we have to bring up other generation very quickly. And that's really one of the unique challenges of the electric industry. Compared to any other commodity, oil, gas, lumber, wheat. If a product's not available, it'll get delivered maybe later and maybe at a different price. But in our industry, we have to be matching the consumer's demand with our generation output second by second because if not, things don't work well. Motors slow down, clocks read the wrong time, and your computer will stop functioning. So that's really one of the unique challenges that we have to keep the system in balance all the time.
Maybe a good thing.
So as I mentioned, the typical output of a wind farm is about one-third of the time. different geographic areas. It can be different. This is about what we've seen with the wind farms in service so far in the Northwest. There are four time frames that we're concerned about. I actually start from the bottom up, seasonally. So the wind does vary around the year, and the wind does blow pretty heavily in the wintertime. But interestingly enough, when we get an extreme cold weather, which is an area that we're concerned, an Arctic Express, like in February of 89, December of 1990, I don't know if you folks remember that far back, typically we have a high-pressure system over the region. The wind actually stops blowing. That's a little challenge for that extreme cold event. In general, wind does help us in the wintertime, but for the extreme event, it's not going to be a great assistance. But in general, one of the good things about the seasonality is it's very predictable. The wind blows the same in July of each year, on average, over the course of the month of July. You can just count on it. How are the day ahead of the time periods that people do planning? How are they going to set up the generation system? What generators am I going to turn on? Which ones am I going to turn off? What am I going to sell into the marketplace? And so it's very important that people develop tools to better predict the day ahead to a couple of hours ahead, because it's very important for the economic operation of the power system. The two at the top of the list are more reliability issues. This goes back to the question of keeping the system in balance. And there are two time frames. The 10 to 20 minute ramps, that's typically the time that it takes an increase in wind or a decrease in wind to pass over the location of a wind farm. And so that's one of the challenges, is following those ramps up and following those ramps down. And then moment to moment, you saw the squiggliness of the lines on the moment to moment basis. And again, we have to keep that in balance. Now, people have said, well, we've got the perfect system here in the Northwest, which is blessed with this hydro resource, which is seems like a perfect match to wind. But there are some challenges. So you folks are well aware of our need for fish operations, which has limited our flexibility. A product that we sell to some of the larger consumer and utilities called Slice, which takes away some of the flexibility of operating the hydro system. The fact that loads are growing, and all of the loads are depending upon the hydro system to deal with the variability. When people put down their toaster in the morning, when they start cooking in the evening, when they run their air conditioner, when they come home from work, everyone depends upon the hydro system to manage that variability. And we have not been adding hydro facilities. We haven't built new hydro facilities in decades. And so we're running out of capability to do that. Those all limit our flexibility of managing the variability of wind. And another thing that we found, actually most of the wind projects are actually purchased now currently by the investor-owned utility. Some is delivered to the consumer-owned, but most of the investor-owned. But they all come across the Bonneville transmission system, and they all rely on the Bonneville federal hydro system to manage out that variability. And so we've got to find a better way of sharing that responsibility, because all the resources are dependent on the federal system for balancing. And I think there's a question, if this variability starts adding cost to the system and managing it, if we have to operate the system differently than today, who should pay for that? Should it be spread across all consumers? Should it be spread across those people who are developing and using wind? These are very challenging political and economic questions that the region needs to answer.
Currently on this system, I was told about 25% of it is from coal-based stuff, Montana and so on. Isn't that part of the variability issue as well, though? And that's not part of the Bonneville system, is it?
So the variability in the coal is, it's pretty consistent. We pretty well understand what the cost of the coal is in long-term contracts, and it operates pretty steadily except when the machine breaks down, which happens from, like, the Boardman coal plant.
Okay.
That does happen. And it operates pretty much throughout the year except in the springtime when we have the runoff. That's when they shut down the coal plants to do their annual maintenance, and there's a lot of low-cost hydro available. But coal plants for efficiency tend to run flat out at one output level. But the loads, as I said, go up and down in the morning and the evening peak period, and we rely on the hydro system and now to a growing extent on some gas turbines to take care of that variability in consumption. So as I said, I wasn't going to just come with you with a litany of problems. I want to offer some solutions. I think this is doable. The first one is we need a forecasting tool, and to be honest, I think it's important that we require that people use it. One of the challenges we face is some wind developers are very secretive about their information. They have metrological data. They're unwilling to share it with anyone. Mm-hmm. We absolutely need access to that data so we can reliably and efficiently operate the power system. We're working with our fellow utilities in the western United States and the Western Interconnection and across the country to develop standards, operating procedures that can help us better manage the variability of the wind. There have been some standards put in place in the last few years. There's more work that needs to be done. I think it's very important for wind developers and for the equipment developers to have national standards to the extent possible so they understand one model that they can operate throughout the United States or North America, so we don't do things differently in Oregon than Washington than Minnesota. It's very important to them. One of the things we can do to address the variability is just slow down our system. Because we have this wonderful flexible hydro system, we respond very quickly to changes. That puts a lot of wear and tear on the wind generator, on the hydro generators, and it's not real good for the fish if the water flow is going up and down. So we probably just need to slow down our response, be sure that people are comfortable that can be done in a reliable manner. Change some of the business practices, the way we sell the products that are used to manage the variability in the generation and the load. And change our rate design, what we charge people for these services. And we probably need to develop some new services, like shaping and storage, where a party may be interested in acquiring wind, but they don't own the generation to balance it out themselves. So they'll come to Bonneville or to other utilities and say, will you take it into your system, smooth it out, and just deliver it to me as I need it? You know, with heavy amounts in the morning and the evening peak and less at night, and you manage it for me with your reservoirs and your other controllable generation. Some of the variability that we deal with is due to the load side. And there are opportunities like non-wire solutions, managing demand, turning off certain electrical consumption for short periods of time, like water heaters. People won't even see that difference. We could also use those types of controls to address the variability of the wind. If the wind starts ramping down, instead of just immediately sending a signal to Grand Coulee Dam to start picking up production, maybe we can turn some people's water heaters off for 5 or 10 minutes. They won't even notice it. We cycle air conditioners in the summertime, irrigation pumps. So I think there are some technological opportunities that could really help us. But again, I emphasize we really need region-wide solutions because Oregon doesn't work on its own and Bonneville can't work alone. The resources to balance the variability in the state of Oregon may come from Washington or may come from Idaho. So we clearly need to have regional solutions. Just want to take a moment to toot our horn. As I said, we've integrated more than 500 megawatts of wind so far. One of the elements of the transmission tariff penalizes people who say they're going to deliver so much power and then don't, either they deliver more or less. And certainly we want it to be balanced out because we don't want them cheating us. If they say they're delivering 500 megawatts to a customer, they've got to supply it. The tariff actually had a very stiff penalty for people who are off by more than 10%, and we eliminated that for wind because they don't really have a lot of ability to control that. So we're one of the first utilities to eliminate the penalty from the standard tariff that most utilities use. Another thing that I'm proud of, as you folks know, there is significant development in the Klondike area and Condon area of wind, and there are also some small generation projects, 10 megawatts and less. And we're facing some challenges about how do we hook them up to the grid, because the transmission system in that area is pretty well stretched out, especially the lower voltage system. So we work with PPM to basically develop a plan to reconfigure for them to move some of their existing generation onto the new transmission facilities we're building for the Klondike and Orion wind projects to make some space for some of these smaller wind projects so we could very cost-effectively hook some of them up. These are the sort of things we just need to approach with an open mind, work with the utilities, work with the developers to find cost-effective solutions that are good for the region. And then there's some high-tech issues. How do you manage voltage control when the wind is varying from time to time? The poor folks in the Condon area have been suffering fluctuations in the voltage ever since the first wind farms were put in there, in part because the wind machines are using the oldest technology, and their voltages tend to vary and vary on the system. So we're looking at some high-tech solid-state devices as a pilot program to try and bring the voltage control back to the people in the Condon area. The two photos on the bottom are some construction work at our substations to hook up wind projects. So I'd like to conclude with a couple of next steps, collecting things from the previous slides. We need to continue to participate in development of standards, both national and regional. And by regional, I mean the western part of the United States, because electrically we're tied together in the West and we have our own standard-setting body along with the national bodies. Excuse me. There's a study underway under the Northwest Power Pool, which is a grouping of utilities in the Northwest, to look at some of the wind integration issues, and we need to finish that work out. I think there are some very large issues that we need to address that are on the previous page. I think we need to pull folks together from around the region. We need to get the states, we need to get the legislatures, the energy offices, the utilities, both investor-owned and consumer-owned, the wind developers, and the interest groups, conservation, the tribes. All of these people we need to pull together in a forum, because, as I said, I don't think any state can solve the wind issues, the wind challenges that we face on their own. We need to develop an integrated approach for the Northwest to address renewable resource challenges.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Roblin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we went to and we looked at the wave energy project, they talked about storing their energy offshore in direct current and then putting it into the system under AC. Have there been any developments in storing energy, taking this alternating currents, wind, storing it DC, and then putting it into it more commonly that's efficient?
So my understanding is that the AC to DC conversion is less an issue of storage as a way of effectively transmitting it over the cables. Particularly when the cables get that long, it's easier to transmit direct current over a cable than it is alternating current. And it may be more effective from the technology approach for the generators themselves, the wave generators and the electronics that are in them. So I think that's a driver. Storage technology is a possibility. There are a number of batteries, large and small, that are being looked at, fuel cells. The technology is very expensive. But I think that if we see a greater need, if we see greater opportunities, if we find that the hydro system can no longer operate as that storage battery, because at some point it's going to reach a limit. I don't know what it is, but there's going to be some point where we just can't move the hydro system around as rapidly as we need to balance. Then we'll have to look at these technologies. And we're at Bonneville, we've been monitoring what others are doing. And, you know, as Dilbert says, change is good, you go first. So we're watching what other folks are doing around the country. There have been a lot of challenges with these very large-scale batteries. For unique applications, they work. PacifiCorp actually has one on the Utah system because of transmission limitations, where they'd have to build an extremely long, expensive transmission line to address a modest amount of load. And so they built a new high-tech battery, which is a great example to take a look at.
Great. Representative Gilman?
Thank you. The control, the response bothered me. Does that mean 90 volts instead of 110?
So there are two things. There are actually two parameters that we monitor on the power system. One is the voltage, and we want to keep that steady, usually plus or minus 5%. And we have other ways of controlling that. The second piece is the frequency, the 60 hertz or 60 cycles per second, and that's the major problem that we see with the variability of wind. Although, as I said, in the Condon area, we have voltage problems because of the very old technology wind machines that they chose to purchase for that project. And so you're right. we want to keep that 60 hertz constant as well, so that your clock is turning at the correct time and your computer works, and so on and so forth. But there are control standards. We have to meet a 90% standard on one of the measures. I won't describe it in detail. Typically, we run about 97 or 98%, so we run very, very tight here in the Northwest. We could probably afford to loosen that, and we'll still meet North American and national standards.
And then we wouldn't notice it too much as consumers.
You wouldn't notice it at all. Unless you had very sophisticated measuring devices in your house, you wouldn't know the difference.
And then I have one more.
Sure.
Too. This wonderful hot water heater that shuts off.
Yeah.
How do you control that?
That was my question.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay.
So I think we'll need to have a separate session to talk about non-wire solutions and demand response. There are a number of technologies. Most of those are done by remote control. So a signal goes out, could be signal sent over the power line, a power line carrier, could use pager technology, could use internet if everyone has high bandwidth connections in their house. All of those technologies have been tested and are viable. Oh, some also use signal over AM and FM radio stations as well. And then the old-fashioned ones use clocks. They would just shut it off for an hour, for a half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the evening. But that doesn't keep consumers very happy.
They know that that's going to be peak load.
I see. Right.
Exactly. That pattern repeats.
It's okay. We're all doing the same thing. Representative Witt, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chairman. During the energy crisis of the early part of this decade, various analyses suggested that our transmission lines and some of the ones that BPA maintains in particular are a virtual disaster. And there were suggestions that the power lines be replaced and perhaps with updated technology. And now I'm at the point where I'm speaking beyond my own knowledge, but I think there were suggestions that maybe it be alternating current lines versus direct current, and that the load capacity would be increased, and there would be benefits in terms of a generation and a lack of lost power along those lines. And I'm just wondering where that may be in BPA's future planning.
So our 100-year-old Thomas Edison design system seems to be working reasonably well. We certainly have seen glitches. Some of the technology approaches that people have suggested are converting the alternating current, which is what we use in our homes, to direct current.
I had it backwards.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Thomas Edison actually was the proponent of the direct current system. He was wrong about that one. But we do have a direct current line that goes from the Dalles, I said, directly to the city of Los Angeles, and that's clearly the most cost-effective way to transmit large blocks of power over long distances. Why that caveat? Because it costs a lot of money to convert from alternating current to direct current and direct current back again. City of Los Angeles just replaced their converters. It cost about $150 million for that one line. And if we were to do that on the hundreds and hundreds of lines on our system, you can take a guess what that would cost for us to do that. I think for certain selected situations, like development of large remote resources, coal and wind in Montana or Wyoming, or the oil sands in Alberta, direct current is clearly the way to go. But I personally don't see that's a viable alternative. There are also special applications, for example, underwater. There's a proposal to develop a cable from Vancouver Island to the Port Angeles area. There's another project that's actually pretty far in the permitting process to bring a underwater direct current cable to San Francisco from the East Bay area. In special applications, I think it's clearly the way to go, and with the newest in solid-state technology, it's very efficient, very reliable, and actually helps support and manage the grid.
Sure.
Thank you. And at the same time, there were I recall discussions about perhaps segmenting out the transmission portion of BPA's operations, and I'm just wondering where that is today.
So I don't believe there is any appetite or interest in the region of separating Bonneville into two separate agencies. We have voluntarily complied with the Federal Energy Regulatory Committee's open access tariff since 1996. We were the first utility in the Northwest to file one, and I think we continue to have a leadership role. We've had a great challenge in the region to try to develop a single organization to manage the grid, this one interconnected grid. The last was a Grid West proposal, which unfortunately fell apart in the last month or so. There are discussions underway for an organization called Columbia Grid that's a little bit less ambitious, maybe more incremental in its approach and the types of problems it's attacking. And I think that might have some chance of success and will help us do the coordinated planning and operation that allow us to operate more reliably and more effectively.
Thank you. And lastly, what kind of provision does BPA have for members of the public to be involved in energy planning out into the future to prevent, which something which I realize was not DEPA's fault, but a reoccurrence of our energy disaster back in that earlier part of the decade?
So I think if there's one thing that Bonneville does well, it's public process to invite input. I don't think we make any decisions without consulting with all stakeholders. Let me describe a little bit on the transmission side, and then maybe Ann could address more broadly some of the regional conversations. So, for example, our program expenditures, our expense program and capital program, we do a public process every 2 years because we tend to set rates in two-year increments. And so the public, all stakeholders, have an opportunity to comment, are we spending too much or too little money in various areas? In fact, that public process will be during the month of June. There'll be a meeting in Portland, and we invite all people to come to our programs and review. We have more detailed public meetings on our capital expenditures. Capital is where we build major infrastructure projects like transmission lines, and we invite again both the technical experts from the region, other utilities, as well as the general public. And then finally, if we were ever to try and site a particular transmission line, we have a very extensive public process under the National Environmental Policy Act, which typically takes about 18 months. So there are a number of opportunities. And then in particular areas, we have a public process on congestion management. We have a public process addressing the question of what is an adequate transmission system that we launched about 2 years ago. So there really are a number of opportunities for all stakeholders to get involved.
I think that the amount of meetings that we have probably is overwhelming to most of our public customers that want to participate. We do all that Brian talks about, and we're also trying to work with the Power Planning and Conservation Council on their power plan, which you probably are aware of. It calls for a certain amount of both conservation and renewables to be integrated and to meet future loads. So we're working with them. And then I think the big thing that will be released in the not-too-distant future is a regional dialogue proposal that talks about how we're going to sell to our public customers and others the resources of the federal-based system and how those customers get their further need resources for load growth in the future after we're going to do 20-year contracts. So there's a lot of opportunity. I'd be happy to pass things on to the committee about how you can get involved.
Great. Just a comment, Madam
sure.
Chair. The state of Oregon's had a great deal of success with public advisory committees, and I just think that might be something that BPA might want to consider.
Thank you. I had a question, I think. I'm not sure. On your next steps, you talk about regional standards. You mentioned regional standards a lot. Are you saying the state should set the summit or forum for setting those standards, or is that something BPA would do?
I had in mind technical standards, and so it's typically the utility community and those experts in the wind community to develop those standards. And I have to admit I was a little loose with the words here. When I said regional in this, I'm talking about the western interconnection. So it's the states in the western United States, because we have a reliability council that manages issues here. that would be the right group. The states are involved. There's CREPSI and a couple of other groups where the states get together, and the states do have a membership and a role in the Western Electricity Coordinating Council in helping set policy and standard setting direction. When I used regional on the bullet lower down, I was thinking more of the Northwest, the Bonneville service territory, and addressing some of these integration questions. How do we rely not just on Bonneville system, but on the whole? If states set standards for acquiring resources and how they're managed, take a look at what your neighbor is doing, because what you say affects what they do.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for a good
presentation. Thank you to the committee and chair for inviting us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know.
Yes? Look in Mr. Myron. Parks is not.
But I wanted to thank Sandy for putting this all together.
Yes, absolutely.
I want to thank the committee person and for driving so well.
Yeah.
Almost 1 minute. Yeah.
Five. Thanks. You guys are next. We were just kind of waiting for them to.
Yeah, just take a second.
Sure. Next, we're going to have an update on the statewide bicycle recreation program. Tim Wood, Scott West, and Bart Everwine. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you can all come up together if you want, or separate, however you want to do. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Wood. I'm the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm here this afternoon to kind of give you an information briefing about a program we call the Statewide Bicycle Recreation Program. And I'd like to provide you a little background as to why we think the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department ought to be in this business, and then kind of explain a little bit about the concept of the program and ask for your assistance or indulgence, if you will, in making this come to pass. As you noted, Scott West from Travel Oregon is here, and Bart Everwine from Cycle Oregon, and both of those gentlemen will have a few comments when I'm complete here. In 2004, we created sort of an ad hoc relationship of bicycle enthusiasts, tourism representatives, government policy, bicycle tour groups, to create what we or to develop what we call the Oregon Bicycle Strategy. And that group has evolved to become what is known today, rather informally, as the Oregon Bicycle Recreation Partnership. And this partnership prompted several partners to join and begin working in promoting recreational bicycling in the state. And two of those partners, as I mentioned, the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department and Cycle Oregon, worked with the Department of Transportation to create the Willamette Valley Scenic Bikeway. And you have a copy of the brochure that outlines what the Willamette Valley Scenic Bikeway is all about in front of you. It covers about 130 miles of county and state roads, goes from Shampooey State Heritage Area near Newburgh to Armitage, what is now Armitage County Park near Eugene, and was inaugurated back on June 25th and 26th last year with about 1,200 people who joined in a ride that was sponsored by Cycle Oregon to kind of bring some recognition to this route. The significance of this is that it highlighted how a bikeway could showcase valley communities, how it could link recreation sites along the Willamette River, how it could guide riders through one of the most diverse agricultural areas on the earth and certainly within the state of Oregon. It had stops at significant points of significance in Oregon's history along the way, and it also showed a way that we could meet the recreation need for bicyclists in Oregon and positively draw attention to the scenic and natural qualities of the Willamette River. After this event was over, the success sort of engendered strong support to look toward expanding that beyond just the Willamette Valley Scenic Bikeway, and also the role in our department in helping promote bicycle recreation in Oregon. The key link here, I think, is to the Oregon State Trails Plan, which is a part of, which is in statute, which we have the responsibility for overseeing. Oregon's policy toward outdoor recreation is expressed in statute, and in the statute that created our department, and it recognizes the state's responsibility in planning for and meeting recreation needs of the population, and it encourages a cooperative approach between government agencies and public-private interest groups to meet those needs. In 1971, the State Trails Act established also in statute recognized the role of trails in promoting public access to and travel and enjoyment, appreciation of the open air, outdoor areas of Oregon, and that trails should be established both near urban areas in this state and within and adjacent to connecting highly scenic areas which are more remotely located. And that's exactly what the Willamette Valley Scenic Bikeway did. Since 2005, several other partners have stepped forward with real offers of support for our program, both in cash and in kind. And they're interested in moving the bicycle recreation program forward as an extension of our department's recreation trails program. So in 2007-2009, our commission has approved a budget package which we will request to go into the governor's budget to create a position and create this program within the department. But we think right now it's vital for us to preserve the spirit and the momentum that we have going toward creating this bicycle recreation partnership by taking some action in the current biennium. So to that end, we will be requesting before the June Emergency Board authority to establish a limited duration position that will allow us to get this underway. And then, as I said, we'll follow that in 2007-2009 with a program option package. The bicycle recreation program is intended to provide a current, productive, growing state bicycle recreation program by combining contributions from several broad-based interests. And this is truly a partnership, including local, regional, state, and federal government agencies, citizen bicycle clubs, bicycle-focused non-governmental organizations, and businesses, all that benefit from recreational bicycling. And this is exactly the kind of partnership that was envisioned in sort of the preamble that I read earlier to the State Trails Act. The immediate focus of this program would be to do two things. One is would be to develop the northern connection of the Willamette Valley Scenic Bikeway Trail from Champuy north to the mouth of the Willamette at the Columbia. And the second immediate objective, would be to work with Oregon communities to create an inventory of Oregon's bicycle recreation resources and other resources that support bicycle recreation activities and deliver that information to the Oregon Tourism Commission for use by Oregonians and visitors, and that would be made available through the Travel Oregon website. Right now, none of the agencies that are involved in the recreation partnership currently have the staffing to support this program on a full-time basis. And as I mentioned, the State Trails Plan, created by OPRD, clearly states that connecting separate trail systems and communities is a key need, and that's one of the major objectives here. Well-planned intercommunity bicycle recreation fills this need and also boosts tourism and rural economic growth. Establishing this program first in the Willamette Basin also helps support the governor's initiative, the governor's Willamette Legacy Program. This initiative is also consistent with the draft Oregon Transportation Plan that is currently out for public comment. So we believe a statewide bicycle recreation program would include low-cost, low-traffic road routes, dedicated paths, multiple-use trails, and networks of community parks and greenways. You'll note that it's building on infrastructure that is already in existence and isn't really adding infrastructure to any system. The bicycle recreation coordinator will work hand-in-hand with specialists in the Oregon Department of Transportation, as I mentioned, who's a partner in this, park professionals at the county and city level, and enthusiasts in the nonprofit and private business world to help us bring some focus to this system. Now, our lottery revenues to OPRD are sufficient in this biennium to financially support the function, and we project to have the funds available in the next biennium as well. So our investments, however, will be coupled with other partners who stand ready, as I mentioned earlier, to bring both cash and in-kind services to this partnership. Oregon Tourism Commission, as I mentioned, would develop and maintain a website for the program. The Oregon Department of Transportation will help by performing cartographic services for mapping and charting. And they would also lend their support through their bicycle and recreation, bicycle and pedestrian safety program. Other private and nonprofit supporters are also committed to providing resources to this effort. So, again, my purpose today is to provide you some information on what this program is about and hopefully solicit your support. As I introduced Bart Eberwein from Cycle Oregon and Scott West from Travel Oregon, you know, there are offers on the table to help build this partnership, both through financial contributions and through a dedication of other resources as well, so that we could start this program in this biennium. And they're willing to come to the table if we'll take the lead in doing that. And our commission has expressed a real interest in doing so. What we're asking for, what we will be asking the emergency board for in the June meeting, will be one half of an FTE or 1 year's worth of an FTE for the remainder of the biennium. As I mentioned, we would also need the limitation to do that, but we have the revenue available to do that, and we project to have the revenue available in the 2007-2009 budget year. So that's kind of what the program is all about. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but also Bart Eberwein from Cycle Oregon, a few comments that he'd like to add as well. So,
thank you. Thank you, committee members. My name is Bart Eberwein. I live in Portland. I've worked 20 years for Hoffman Construction Company. I'm an officer of the company, and I'm a 10-year board member of Cycle Oregon. And I don't get to do this very often, so I would like to say thank you to each of you for being our representatives, for taking on the job, for coming down here. I'm going to do what probably a lot of people do in this chair. I'm going to tell you things you already know, and you're going to sit there and look interested. And that's probably one of the easiest parts of your job. And I don't get a chance to thank you guys much, but I want to thank you for volunteering. We need more people that will step up and do that. So here, I'm going to tell you stuff you already know. We live in a beautiful state. And we have the most gorgeous summer, I bet you, of any state in the Union. And we have a tremendous network of roads that are off the beaten path. You know, you get off I-5, I-84, and there's some beautiful roads out there. And there's wonderful little towns that welcome visitors and make them feel like they've been expecting them. And you don't have to spend any money there, but if you do, you're going to get really good service. And maybe make a friend. So that's kind of how this idea started. And my pet line on this is the table is set. You know, God set the table, you know, with a little help from the road builders. But this is one terrific place to ride a bicycle. So let me talk about two ways that I think what Tim is talking about can be transformational and really help the state of Oregon. One is its health benefits. Just a side note, my company, pushed by a couple of us that really cared about this, has started a wellness program, and we've come to find out we're in a real minority. Not many big companies, we have a lot of employees, really have a strong program to encourage their employees to exercise, walk to work, wear a pedometer, get your cholesterol tested regularly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We actually go as far as getting these people coaches when they feel helpless about how to start exercising. So I think it probably doesn't take much to convince you. We've got a health problem. We've got a lot of people that are overweight. We've got an aging population that has high blood pressure. Diabetes or pre-diabetes is rampant. Heart disease. All of these things, you'll hear it over and over again. Exercise and diet. Exercise and diet are the first step to turning around and having good health. Bicycling is an easy way to ease into exercising, and it's an easy sport to take up and go into old age with. It isn't as hard on the joints as running and those kinds of things. And it's really healthy except for cars. Every time a bicycle tangles with a car, even when it's their fault, the car might have a scratch on it. The bicyclist usually goes to the hospital. I mean, that's just the way it works. So what Tim's talking about helps that situation out. It marks these roads and kind of says, here's how you get off the beaten path. The people that you'll be going by recognize that they're, you know, you get over to the left, you wait until you're not in a curve to pass, those kinds of things. So we think a partnership with Parks and Recreation really increases bicycle riding, both for visitors and people that live here, is going to have tremendous health benefits. The second thing, and the one that's probably closer to my heart, is the economic benefits. Especially for the small towns. You know, Portland can take care of itself. I'm not that interested in bringing a lot of visitors in to ride around Portland. If they do, that's fine. But it's getting outside of the big towns and into the small towns and spending some money. And I've seen this firsthand with Cycle Oregon. The typical bicycle tourist looks like this. 45 to 65 years old and rich. And they're looking for adventure, and they're looking for scenery, and they're looking for a place to spend money. One of our biggest problems on Cycle Oregon is we can't find enough places for them to spend money. We're camped out in the middle of a farmer's field, and these guys are going home with as much money as they brought, and that pisses them off. Excuse me. That leaves them unhappy. They want to spend money. They're on vacation. People equate spending money and vacations in the same breath. So if you squint and look into the future, and what Tim is describing with a bicycle concierge, everybody kind of gets that concept. A bicycle concierge housed at the Parks and Recreation Department that facilitates visitors coming to our state from all over the country, riding their bicycles into the small towns and spending money. I think it can transform Oregon. I think it can give us a reputation as a hospitable place to go and take a bicycle adventure, and it's a growing sport. And no other state has really stepped up. You know, Wyoming went after cowboys, and everybody in the world knows Wyoming cowboys. They do a lot more there, but they decided to brand themselves around cowboys. In Utah, it's skiing. And I think we have a real opportunity here. If we put this concierge in place, if we make this partnership work, public-private, to let people know around the country, and maybe even around the world, hey, Oregon, that's where they ride bikes. You looking for something to do this summer? Take your bike out and ride in Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott West, and I'm with the Chief Strategy Officer with Travel Oregon and Oregon Tourism Commission, and thrilled to be here with you today. And my comments are going to be very brief because I think Mr. Wood and Mr. Eberwein have hit on the issues that are important to the commission. We have been engaged. Tourism has been engaged in the bicycling community, I think, back in 1988, I think, when Cycle Oregon got its first start was with Jonathan Nicholas and some others, and I think matched with the Oregon Tourism Commission and got that launched. And so from the Tourism Commission, that's about the time that tourism started coming into its own, too, as its own agency. So we've sort of paralleled this growth over the last, you know, 20 years with our match with and our interest in the bicycling community itself. We are a partner, a vested partner in the current situation. We support the program that Tim has outlined here for you today, both as a both from a human asset perspective, the industry and the organization is committed that way, also financial contributions to see this succeed. And we do believe that cycling offers a interesting and a vital and a lucrative niche moving forward in the in the tourism marketplace. Now, tourism is not the majority of the marketplace itself, as Mr. Eberwein talked about. You know, the Oregonians themselves, the citizens of this state, benefit from this program in the sense of getting that inventory of cycling paths and opportunities off-road and on-road, and finding many of us becoming visitors in our own state. But both from a domestic perspective and an international perspective, the cyclists, as Mr. Eberwein identified, is a potentially high-yield, low-impact contributor to our local and state economies. And frankly, as we talked about, we see it as certainly as an economic development tool, our relationship here, and specifically, most importantly, or I don't know, most importantly, but on an incremental basis, it does contribute to the rural parts of Oregon. On the yield there is higher than it is in other parts of the state. So for all of those reasons, both economic and social, economic and cultural, we believe that moving a bicycling program forward in this united and way that really depends on not just one entity to carry the ball, but literally both this public-private-civic partnership that we think holds a great opportunity for the future. So, interesting, about what a month ago we there's been a group that's been meeting. We talked about this group around tourism, bicycling, and we held a there was a bike summit held in Eugene about a month or 5 weeks ago that was in conjunction with the governor's tourism conference. It had organizations like ourselves, we had county agencies, we had federal agencies, we had bicycle shops, we had manufacturers, we had tour efforts. We had 140 people showed up to this from all venues, I mean from all all segments of the bicycling community, interested and vested in seeing process like this moving forward to give the opportunity to share the health benefits, cultural benefits, and the economic benefits of cycling with the state. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative?
Just a blabbermouth today, aren't I, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you are, but that's okay. Must be the
Tim, the first one's for you.
You've just recently taken on the state fair, and I wonder how you say with confidence you're going to have the dollars for this position with that enterprise also.
Sure, Chair Burley, Representative Gilman, we have programmed in our budget for the coming biennium based on lottery projections and other revenue sources that we have our projected budget for 0709 accounts for a worst case scenario for the state fair accounts for a continuing loss in the state fair, and accounting for that in the coming biennium, we would still have funds projected to be available to cover that.
And then one more, Mark, you talked about cars and bicycles. I'm from Southern Oregon. We have a bike trail down there along Bear Creek that doesn't have cars on it. And I think that's the ideal way to do it. I also know you can't find the money to do that sort of thing statewide. Are you really careful about making these routes on low-traveled roads so that we may not have too many collisions?
Representative Gilman, that is a great question, and I'd have to, when you ask it, I immediately think of the Cycle Oregon meetings. Every year we lay out a different route, go about 500 miles around the state, and we try not to repeat routes. We're going on our 19th year. And every year we are tempted to go on a Highway 126 or even get on a freeway for a little while. And every year we sort of have to remind ourselves that there's nothing worse than a car tangling with a bicycle on a vacation, where we've sat as a board and enticed people through our advertising to come with us and have a safe, fun vacation. So I think that in all the meetings I've sat with where we try to identify the small roads that would connect parks and some of these hard-hit communities to bring tourists in to fill the restaurants and the bed and breakfasts, safety is the first thing we talk about. It's not a perfect world. There's going to be accidents, and we'll be second-guessing every decision. But I think there's a network of roads out there, and I think that there's goodwill, a lot of goodwill, both on the part of bicyclists who are like, thanks for getting over, Mr. Guy delivering a big hayload, because I know you're in a hurry. But you see that when it works. You're kind of waving back and forth, and I think there's goodwill. I spend a lot of time in the bike saddle in the summer, and there's an awful lot of goodwill in these small towns and in rural communities from the drivers that'll wait until there's a safe place to pass, and then. So I'm hopeful, but I sure wouldn't sign it in ink and say there'll never be an accident.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just a comment that I'm thinking, Mr. Chair, if gasoline gets much more expensive, I'm going to dust my Schwinn off. So that, seriously,
yeah,
there's going to be more bike riders because of the cost of gasoline. And anything that keeps them out of the flow of traffic, keeps them from being a pizza on somebody's front bumper, is something we got to work on.
I think, may I comment on that? Okay. I think that that this concept of a concierge makes a lot of sense because people hear the general advertising or the buzz, go to Oregon Bicycle, and they will want to call someone and say, where is it safe? And I think it's a great role for Parks and Rec to say, you know, here's a nice way that you can get from Portland or Eugene or someplace to the coast, rather than have them just try to open a map and figure it out on their own and end up on Highway 18 or one of these places that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
So, it's a good comment.
Okay. If I understand, Tim, this correctly, you're looking for a position that, as you said here, it's just coordinating these efforts. What about things like bike lanes and, I mean, some real, you know, brick and mortar, so to speak? I mean, that's, you know, Central Oregon, we've got the Cascade Cycling Classic and Century Drive and all this stuff, and there's no, I mean, you're riding right out on the road.
Right.
And I, you know, I've never had the pleasure of doing Cycle Oregon, but I do spend a lot of time out in Eastern Oregon, and I know the roads out around Sumter and those places that you have gone and through halfway, and frankly, I wouldn't want to be riding my bike on those roads. And what are we doing about bike lanes? I mean, that to me is one of the first things we can do for safety, because we're not obviously going to be paving two-lane bike paths all across Eastern Oregon.
Mr. Chair, the bicycle and pedestrian program, which is a part of ODOT, is charged specifically with, you know, in, helping ODOT meet the requirement for the federal requirement for providing bicycle lanes on highways and highway design and how to configure those into intersections and that sort of thing. So it's kind of, you know, going forward, being able to designate and designate bike lanes on existing highways or new highways to be constructed, that kind of falls under the, you know, the purview of the bicycle and pedestrian group within ODOT. However, our role would be to work with those folks in helping to helping to ensure that those requirements are being met, and also to help identify other locations where bike lanes don't currently exist that it might be appropriate to include those. They would also work with us, as they had in the establishment of the bikeway here, in helping identify safe areas to cross, and so that when we sign routes that we're, you know, we're taking into consideration the most safe route given the conditions that exist and so forth. So it would be an ongoing partnership that we would have with ODOT in that role.
Well, to follow up on Representative Gilman's question, I mean, you say in your written testimony here that you have the lottery revenues to support this, that really what you're looking for from the e-board is the additional lottery limitation. And yet you said, if I understand correctly, that, you know, your program budget continues to show the state fair operating as a deficit. As much as I like this idea, and that I'm a big fan of bicycling, I guess I'm just kind of struggling here trying to reconcile the fact that we've got a deficit operation over here and we want to put some money into a function that...
Oh, sure. Well, Chair Burley, what I'm trying to say is that the money that would go toward the bicycling program is not at the expense of anything else. Our revenues, as a result of principally, you know, increased revenues from the lottery, have helped us to offset the operating deficit with regard to the state fair. So, I mean, they're not in competition with each other. And in fact, as I said, we have projected, in worst case scenario, as we go into our next biennium's budget, that we have the revenues to continue the state fair operating at a deficit, and there would still be funds available to do this. I mean, that's a worst-case scenario, would be that, you know, that we would lose as much money with the fair in the coming biennium as we have lost in this or previous bienniums. That's for planning purposes. Just to tell you the truth, that isn't our business objective with regard to the state fair.
Mm-hmm.
Our business objective with regard to the state fair is make it break even or better. And it's going to take some time to do that, but I think we're on the track to get that done.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My feeling is that I like the idea in the sense that I've always been concerned. We call it Parks and Rec, and we have been parks. We really haven't been wrecked. And recreation is really the thing that we need to use the parks for, other kinds of things. And this at least starts us on that venture of saying recreational part of Parks and Recs has something to it. And it gets people out moving and doing things. You know, Cycle Oregon's come through Coos Bay, went by the high school, used the fields for tents and all those things. And I think it rejuvenated a group of people who now there's a lot more bikers than there used to be that are out there on their pedaling and doing stuff. In fact, we have four police officers in England right now on an exchange cycling in England, and they had some bobbies come over cycling in Oregon, and now we've got this group going over to England. So I think this is the right time to start looking at those things, and I think it is the right opportunity for the rec to get involved with the rec part of Parks and Rec, to get involved with other community groups, to start putting out a healthy lifestyle that would be good for Oregon. And you know, with the other things that we've sold on tourism in the past and stuff, I think it sits there right now at a good place for that to happen. So I think it's an idea. I'm pleased that we're not looking at putting something in that we don't have a revenue source for, a stream that can let it continue, because I would hate to start something with emergency board and then end it at the end of the time. So it pleases me to realize that you've looked ahead to see those kinds of things. And I would hope that we continue to look for areas where Park and Rec can, you know, work with communities to put together recreational programs. We lost a lot of those the last 25 years, and most communities used to have recreation programs, which I think helped with the obesity problems with kids and all those kinds of things, and we've lost most of them in our small communities. And this is the beginning, maybe, to get some of that back. That, to me, is a good, healthy thing. So I appreciate hearing about it.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
If not, thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Thank you.
I believe we have no one signed up for public comments. So with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn.